Hi, this is David Russell. This is episode number 36 of the No Bad Bosses podcast. Today's episode is sponsored by Dave's Charm School. It is soft skills training for your employees because we all need to be better at interacting with others, following up, running meetings, dealing with conflict, and a lot of other EQ type of skills that we need to be our best in our work environment. So check it out, 14-day free trial. I mean, why not try a course? You can take an exam, see what you think. Visit managetowin.com/charm school to learn more. My guest today is John Wilson of Trek Networks, new company title anyway. And we get into millennials, we get into what is a good leader, a bad leader. I think there's some good tips here. I wouldn't miss it. Here we go. Man, yeah, it was. I took my 11-year-old to the doctor. And their ash has fallen on the car. That cleared out a little bit, but it's as smoky as it was yesterday. I mean, literally, I can't see that hill. So we are live now. This is David Russell, and you are with the No Bad Bosses podcast. We love this, don't you like that, John? I mean, come on, love you're it. Not a bad boss. You've nice actually become nice. Quite a good boss in the 3-4 years we've worked together.
I try. I mean,
that's why I've got you on. So this is John Wilson of Trek Networks, which is a new name for your company that's not formally even announced yet.
In the process, we're teasing it right now. We're 2 weeks away from go live. So
yeah. But that's cool. That's got to be exciting. And just to reference, if that caught in the as we came on that. And I'm here in Novato, California, where you're just south of the Sonoma and Napa County fires. And the smoke is so bad here out my windows. I'm looking out windows here. I cannot see a local hill, Mount Burdell, that is like a mile from me. So it's that bad. I didn't notice ashes this morning, but we did have a nice bright orange sunrise, which is not a good thing.
Sounds a good thing, but not good.
Yeah. So, John, you just got back from a United Way conference. Is that their national or worldwide? What is that?
So, it is a national one. It was actually their finance, technology, and talent management national conference. So, they do different ones. So, this was originally centered on finance, and then they realized that technology is so integrated into the finance and the management of the United Ways that they added technology a number of years back.
And so you got invited to speak there. That was the thing from one of your clients who's at United Way.
And we've been engaged with them for about a year and a half. We did some things with them with just their network and with security. And they said, hey, we appreciate what you brought to the table and how we did a consultative approach. And would you mind speaking at the conference? We think there's a big niche for what you guys do with security for what the rest of United Way regions need to hear. So we actually create a security presentation and tailored it to the market that we're speaking to, United Ways and nonprofits, and made it as a edutainment. So we actually started with a security game, right? And then kind of taught about the top 5 cybersecurity threats and how to mitigate them, and then had another game and talked about how to really build a culture of security in the organization.
So how are the games received? I'm kind of curious because, as leaders, we struggle to be effective communicating, just day-to-day interactions. But then you got to get in front of a group, whether it's your own group or an outside group like this case. I know you worked on this presentation. And so how did the games go over?
They went over very well. Different than what I was expecting, though. So the first one, it's like a video vignette and kind of a choose your own adventure. So it plays a short 20-second video clip, and then you have to pick one of 3 choices. So we went table by table. We did a vote table by table. So when a table was ready for their decision, they would say if they're voting 1, 2, or 3, and then we tallied the votes and picked the majority. Some tables were quick, and others it was like delegation, right? So, I mean, I guess considering the audience, right? So pick one, guys. It's like they're still talking. Everybody else picked. They're still talking. I'm like, we're gonna go ahead with what everybody else said. So it's kind of fun to see the dynamics play out there. Definitely engaged, but you could see some interesting cultural dynamics there.
That's great. About how many people did you have in the audience?
We had about 40.
Okay. That's a reasonable size, you know, at a conference that like that. And the key is the engagement level. What do you think on the engagement level on a scale of 1 to 10? How engaged were they, with 10 being super engaged?
I'd say overall about 7 or 8. This was the last day of the conference, and it was one of the last, one of the second to last sessions. We're like, we probably should have went for an earlier day, and I don't remember if we had a choice in that or not. So they were a little bit tired. The games, you definitely perked them up there, and we definitely had about 15 people come up to us at the end to engage in conversation. So we got great engagement, but I think they were just they were tired and of being at a conference for 3 days.
That's a toughie. Yeah, that's always a toughie, being at the end of a conference, you know, particularly a 3-day conference like that.
Talked to us at the end. So from that one, I was like, okay, we got great takeaways and we've already started engaging in conversation already. So that from that perspective, it was definitely a great success.
Well, that's good. Now, flipping to your more local, your organization there in Laurel, Maryland. So, you know, you and I started working together, I think, like 4 years ago. And at that time, you had to, I think you had 3 family members, you know, working in your organization. And we've had some podcasts, to be candid with you. I don't know whether you keep up with the podcast, with people who successfully work with family members. In your case, you love your family members, but it just really wasn't working out that well in the business. So you had some difficult choices to make. What can you say there that would help some of the leaders that might be in a similar situation?
Definitely true. And frankly, slightly jealous of those podcasts and the successes of those involved. But, you know, come to realize that sometimes as much as you respond and you act, sometimes there are things outside of your control that, you know, you just can't turn, you know, let into gold, frankly. And sometimes it's not so much a quality of thing, it's just it being a fit, round peg, square hole sort of scenario. And after so much effort, it just becomes unwise and irresponsible to keep trying to get that round peg in a square hole. It becomes foolish. And I think that's kind of a way to kind of sum it up. But, you know, there were just some round pegs and square hole scenario in terms of the organization I was trying to build or had built up that point where I was trying to have it go. And the people had in certain positions that were family, and definitely loved them all. And different relationships, because they were, you know, both blood related family and in-law related family. Right. So you had both. And so it was difficult to mitigate through. It was very challenging. But here I am now, and I'm post that. And I currently don't have any family in the business. And we are doing much better. And that's not necessarily a success, right? Because I looked at, you know, the Heinz Corporation before they sold out, you know, multi-billion-dollar ketchup empire and all these other local things. And it's doable, right? But it may not be doable based on your mileage and, you know, the type of vehicle you have and, you know, if you city miles or, you know, highway miles.
Well, you know, it's funny. I didn't think about this when I was considering asking you the question, but back in the 1980s, about 1988, even earlier than that, this was like 1984. That's how I got into the computer industry, was doing trade shows. And I hired a consultant to help me. And his name, if you can believe it, was Roger Blewett. Now think of how you grow up with a name like Blewett as your last name, you know, you blew it, Blewett, you know, whatever. But he was reasonably good. But I'll never forget, he said something at the time. I had a bunch of family members working for me, and I think they did reasonably good work. But he said, look, he said, you can't have any family members working for you. You're not big enough yet. You're not, you know, when you're bigger and, you know, you're 50 employees or something like that, then maybe you can have family members. But right now, you can't. You got to get the best people possible in the roles in the organization. And it was good advice. No negative reflection on any of the family members at the time. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, it was good advice. And typically what I find And I think it was your situation too, is, you know, these decisions are very difficult. So they're not made necessarily on a timely basis.
Right.
They're typically overdue by a few months, if not much more than that.
Yeah. So, more than that in my case.
Yeah. But now you've got a situation where you got a young group and you've got Mario has worked with you for how many years as service manager? I mean, he's almost like family. He doesn't qualify, but.
12 years. Yeah. I mean, it's considering family comes over, you know, the weekend of Thanksgiving, we fry turkey together. So we bond. We bond over fried poultry. So
it works. Yeah. It works. Hey, I remember Joe Cram over at Solid Networks. He had one of those, not a barbecue, but it was the smoker. He had a smoker, yeah, where he would smoke meats once a month for his crew. Required a little effort, but boy, it was a bonding thing. They all loved that for that lunch. It was a good thing. So I'm kind of curious, you've got your organization now, you're doing well. And what are some stories that you would pick out that you would want to share, either personal experience or ones from your team or whatever, good or bad bosses? I mean, you've been around a while, John. How many years business experience do you have now?
So business experience, 16 with this company. And then I was a VP for another company for 6 or 7 years before that. And then just doing consulting for about 4 or 5 years there. So 25 years or so, just working in the industry. So a good bit.
Okay. Adds up.
It does add up pretty quickly. So should we start on a positive note or the not so positive note? Where do you want to start at?
Well, normally when I'm telling somebody that they're going to have a conversation with somebody and there's negatives and positives, they get the negatives out of the way first. So probably if you want to focus on the drama, the bad bosses, we start with them.
All right, let's start some drama here, right? Let's start with that. So I had a client a number of years back, no longer a client, haven't been a client in a while. Oh, a long while. And so they were in the manufacturing industry. I'll keep it generic. And their culture and their facility, and there were $150 million to $250 million companies, so large size manufacturer here in Maryland, and they were on a growth path. They had started acquiring other plants, and I was brought as a consultant to help them integrate the networks and such. But the culture that was there, and particularly as it stemmed from the leader, right, the CEO, it was the traditional. Everybody's afraid of the boss. You don't want to be around the boss. Don't let the boss see you. Don't look in his downside. And there's one particular story that stood out. This is as they're, you know, after they had grown and they started having some trouble breaking into a new market. They were reaching out to other states, and they were starting to have a problem. Now, mind you, this company was an open book company. So open book management is an approach by which they share all the financial information with the company, as well as key decisions. So like healthcare was voted on by the staff, by the factory workers, and all that sort of thing. So, you know, that sort of approach. So they're having problems, and they said, you know, hey, he came out and said to his regular weekly meeting where he updates everything and gets, you know, buy-in from the staff. Does anyone have any ideas for how we can, you know, reduce costs and drive up revenue? And, you know, he was really, you know, at a spot where he was having a hard time and, you know, wanted some input from the staff. Well, one person in the office staff members, somebody that worked in between customer service and accounting, came up with an idea, and he didn't like that idea. And wow, he just annihilated that guy. Because they had opened up like a remote office in one field for some sales guys, with like 3 or 4 sales guys. And they were spending some ridiculous amount of money, like $10,000 a month on it. And it was a waste. It was a loss. They'd been there for a year. It's like, I think we should close that. And just if we want to have like a salesperson there work out of his home, right? Really good idea, actually, right? And he just annihilated the guy, embarrassed him. That's the stupidest idea. I said I wanted ideas to help us grow. That's just the dumbest idea ever. I mean, just like, this is unbelievable. Like, is this really going on? Like, this is something you see on a bad TV comedy show. Like, am I living through this?
your lead in had me believing. I'm thinking, well, this sounds pretty good, actually. This sounds like a good boss, you know, open, transparent books, management, getting input. Oh boy.
It was unbelievable. And then the drama in the office, that's all anybody could talk about. And this guy, I mean, he was like defeated walking in. It was beyond. I mean, for those that are involved in business, they know like net promoter score, NPS, right? So it's a ratio, I think, from like 0 to 10 or 1 to 10 and below a 6 or 7, whatever people are talking about. This guy had like a -10. I mean, he was constantly talking about how he now hated the CEO. He was a despicable human being. It was so bad. I was like, oh, man. Wow. And then I don't think that led to, but it definitely sped up the process of them losing other factories and having to lay off. And just, you know, it was at the beginning of that, but I know that accelerated their downward spiral. So
That's too bad. I think in last week's podcast, it was that we had John Pearson and Mike Pate, and Mike has this thing, a refrigerator sign he had on his sign he for his kids. The top part said, you take 100% responsibility for your life. Mm-hmm. So they have to take responsibility for what happens. And then he had something that was from the chicken soup guy. I can't remember that author, but he said he didn't come up with it, but that's where he got it from. Which was E plus R equals O. So yeah. Events plus response equals outcome. And you think of your leader's situation there. He set up the event. Give me input, give me ideas. But his response was totally inappropriate, negative. And so it just drove everything into the rocks when it came to the outcome.
Completely. You know, we were talking, I was talking with the staff, we had a meeting yesterday and a lunch, and I was just asking for, hey, any, you know, good boss, bad boss stories. So we started talking about some things and like, yeah, I can't bring that one up. No, I can't say that one either. It's a good one. So we kind of, you know, morphed into a discussion about leadership versus authority, right? A lot of bad leadership. And I was like, you know, it's like a lot of those things are just people that have authority, but they're not really leaders, right? I mean, you could argue they're leading things to a bad place, but they're just, I'll kind of give a high level of this one scenario that my team's dealing with. The boss at one location in their service industry, and there was some overlap, some stepping on toes. They had gotten some equipment that they had asked us for a quote for. And then we kind of, you know, had a regular meeting there and kind of asked about that and like, you know, hey, what's going on? And one person was going to apologize for doing that, saying we stepped out of bounds. And the boss was like, oh, shush them up and said, oh, no, we had that equipment laying around. When in reality, the other person later, well, before the meeting and after, apologized saying we purchased the wrong equipment because we really shouldn't be buying this. We should be buying it from you. And the boss is just shushing them up from doing the right thing and bold face lying about it. And yeah, it's like, that's unbelievable. And in this day and age, it's like, why, you know, your size of company, the amount of dollars we're talking about is trivial. Why would you do this? You know, the culture that sets.
What a role model. So yeah, that comes across so much is, you know, we have to be role models in all that we do. And, you know, that's so foolish. I agree with you. You just wonder, where does somebody get that? And you mentioned this concept where leaders have authority. You have a certain amount of authority based on your position or your ownership when you're an owner.
Right.
And that doesn't mean you're a leader it can mean you're a leader, but not a good leader, not an effective leader, just because you have authority. I've had bosses like that.
Of saying leader implies people want to go someplace good, right? So really the context of when you say leader implies you want to go someplace good. And when someone is being a bad leader or just really just abusing their authority, right? They're just exercising their authority for the sake of exercising it because they want to or they can. they aren't really being a leader, because the team, the company, the group, what the context of that wants to go someplace good, right? And they're not able to do that, or they're choosing not to do that. So I think in those cases, a good or strong argument could be made. They are not leaders. They're just people in positions of authority.
That's interesting. Now, you know, last week we talked a lot about millennials with Mike and John. I'm kind of curious. You've got some millennials and you've done a focus on that. You do an excellent job of engaging with a local college there and then hiring, you know, graduates. So what are you seeing as far as what the millennials want from leaders?
So what I'm seeing, and I saw the webcast last week, and I definitely would agree with a lot of the parts there. I think that there's a lot of good in the millennials, right? Not that you don't always see every side to things from the stereotypes and such like that. But I think it starts with picking people that match your values, right? Because of any generation, there's the, you know, the hardworking and those that are not, right? That's been forever, right? You go back thousands of years, there's always going to be people that are going to work hard and people that aren't, right? But making sure that you pick people that are going to match your values for how you're trying to operate your organization or your company. That for what you need to train or what you need to do or take care of. Actually, David, I think I lost you there on the phone or the screen. I'm sure we're still recording here. There you back. All right.
Yeah. Sorry. I had a slow connection there, so I zapped my webcam for just a moment because I wasn't hearing your audio. So forgive me. So go ahead, keep on. I'm kind of curious on this millennial standpoint and building on this.
Start with people that innately inside match your values, right? From there, you can train, you know, skills as long as they have an interest in doing what you have an interest in. And at that point, I think they've appreciated that more so than the previous generations, right? I think from the previous generations and older folks, I think it was more about work and more about just, you know, getting a career and making money. So you couldn't always discover their values very easily. I think millennials are easier to discover their values because it's been more broadcast about values as they're growing up. So I think they have a better understanding of what values are. I think you still got to dig for them necessarily, but I think in previous generations, I think there was a lot more pretenders because they knew what they were supposed to do, but they really didn't care about it because work was just work. Versus millennials, there's more to life than just work, and you need to find some sort of purpose. You need to find something, you know, of value in work beyond just, you know, punching a clock.
You know, it's interesting you say that because my grandfather, who grew up in the Depression, was a very strong influence in my life, in addition to my parents. And he, along with my parents, taught me how to work hard. And that was a value, was hard work. And being fairly proactive about that. When you worked, you worked. However, he did not do an effective job, nor did my parents, as much as I love them, and they were, all of them were very loving, on teaching me how to work smart. And there's a difference there as far as how the values work. And then you're bringing up the concept of meaningful work, exactly what you do. A lot of times, what we were taught back in the boomer generation was there was a lot of comparison going on. You know, whether it was, you know, keeping up with the Joneses, quote unquote, or whether it was, you know, you want to be a doctor because, you know, doctors make lots of money and, you know, they have a good career and that type of thing versus the concept of, well, what do you love doing? Where are your strengths? How do you apply those strengths? It sounds like you're seeing more of that with the millennial side.
I'm seeing they're more receptive. They're if you look at them as a raw, you know, group of people, right? They're more receptive. They're a lot closer to that than the previous generation, say the boomers were. The boomers were It's hard work, you know, nose to the grindstone, go. What do I need to do? Okay, I need to be like that. Great. You know, what values do I need to have? Yes, I'll have those values. Like, okay, that's not what this is about. It's more of discovering what's there, and then we'll teach you the skill versus you're going to contort yourself to the values of the company. And I mean, if you think about IBM, and I met a lot of old IBMers, and I don't know if you heard any of those stories, but they used to have guards and inspectors, managers, whatever, at the front, and it'd be a long hallway, and you had to walk past all these people, and someone would actually ask you to pull your pants leg up. This is for the men, and you had to make sure you had blue socks, blue dress socks. If you did not, if you had black dress socks with your blue suit, you were sent back home. And I've heard that consistently from multiple sources, you know, from back in the 60s and 70s, like, you know, they wanted you had to conform to their values, right? The expectation was we would beat you down into submission, right? And then morale would improve. So, and productivity, of course, as well. So that was that generation, right? That's what that culture was.
And it's interesting with the millennials. Oh, you can go ahead if you want.
I was gonna say, and it kind of bled over, right? There's not a clean delineation. So even those that came after them still kind of understood that and kind of expected that to a certain degree.
Well, it's interesting that with millennials, what I'm sensing or reading or hearing and learning from them is, you know, they distrust authority. You know, she brought up the authoritarian leader. Yeah. Just because you are in that position doesn't mean they trust you.
Right. I think they're looking for it to be earned. They're looking to be led. They're not looking for authority from I need somebody to, you know, enforce the rules and, you know, to be a hard and fast, you know, curb. I'm looking for someone to guide me. I'm looking for guiding lights. I'm not looking for curbs. Right. I think before it was, you know, it's kind of like the, those speed cars at Disney World or other amusement parks where you had that little strip in the middle, right? And you really weren't really driving. You're pushing on the gas pedal, but if you turn hard to the right or left, the little metal thing whacked you, and the steering really wasn't that good, so you could barely control it. You're just getting whacked every time you turned, and the middle guidepost hit the metal thing or the concrete thing, right? That was it, right? What they're looking for is guiding lights to guide them through, and I think from a leadership perspective, they respond very well to it. From an authority perspective, not so much. Again, if you're tied together and it's you, authority is exercised in the light or the perspective of leadership, they respond fine. But authority by itself, yeah, they're going to bucket that every time.
Yeah, so they're looking to be inspired. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting that there seems to, I mean, we've always had challenges in our nation and worldwide. I mean, those are ongoing. We seem to have a particularly high amount of them at the moment and some rather precarious situations. But it seems like that there are a certain number of millennials that have this innate coding in their DNA that they're waiting. Kind of like sleepers. How do you like that? That's kind of scary. Kind of like sleepers. They're waiting to be inspired to be involved in a movement of change. And I think we've seen that in certain nations happen, but we're talking about leaders involving.
I'd say mentored. One thing that's come up with all the team, and I hear consistently over and over and over again, is that, you know, when there's some sort of either, you know, a major support ticket or a major project or something, I'll get involved, right? And I'll go see how things are going, and I'll either kneel down next to the desk or I'll pull up a chair and have some comments or whatever. And they're like, oh, wow, thanks. I was struggling with that. And they've mentioned, like, wow, they like the fact that I'll come in there and give them a hand, or, you know, Mario will come over and give them a hand, but that we're just not managing from afar and telling you what to do, aka authority. But we're willing to come in there and show you something. And if you're doing it a certain way and there's a better way, we'll actually, you know, show you or say, come over here, let me show you how to do it this way, try this way out. And I've heard it a lot, like, wow, they really like that we don't just leave them alone, but we'll come alongside of them and help them and teach them something new.
Well, and it's interesting. It's like the good cop, bad cop leadership that I teach. The good cop comes alongside. So when you come alongside there, sincerely, empathetically listening, not come alongside or come above them like an authority figure, like your guy that you gave us the example of Bad Boss was playing Whack-A-Mole, the arcade game. You know, he said, hey, somebody give me some ideas. The guy gave an idea that he didn't like and he whacked him. So what you're doing, there's actually a subconscious, you know, physical thing there where you're literally coming alongside, or as you said, you know, getting on one knee near them to kind of see the screen, what's going on. There's a message there. I'm there for you. I value you as a member of the team, and we'll get through this, versus the authoritarian approach of you will get through this or else.
Right. Right.
So that's interesting. So anyway, I'm sorry to go down that rabbit trail a little bit with millennials, but you did add some additional perspective there, which I appreciate. So what about your other thoughts you have on bad or good leadership? You had that conversation. I'm kind of curious.
Yeah. So when we talked through some other, you know, clients, some were technology focused, where it was, some of the technology VPs or directors, they had a lot of experience being a technology person, and now they've transcended into a leadership role, and they're having a very difficult time transitioning, right? They keep going back to wanting to second guess decisions that were made on technology months ago that then delay projects, put everything on hold, carrier circuits get put on hold. And then the executive's like, why isn't this project finished? I'm like, well, it's been put on hold. And then they have to have internal discussions and such. And that's a common, you know, kind of a bad boss scenario from a technology standpoint, right? Where they having a problem just making a decision and compartmentalizing and moving it on. I just want to kind of go back and keep second guessing it to be like a technician, like they used to be, or an engineer. So there's a lot of conversations around that. And something that they saw very clearly, like if you just took a step back, kept going with the decision, the project would have been done, would have been happy, versus it being stalled because of, you know, second guessing or acting like an engineer versus a VP.
Yeah, I find that that is a struggle for a lot of people, and shifting roles. There are some leaders, by the way, where, for instance, I know one guy at one partnership where one's the strong technology partner, one's the strong sales partner. And I advise them, you know, the sales guy should just do sales. He really doesn't, you know, have a leadership acumen. He doesn't have that approach, and it would be difficult for him, but he's a superstar sales guy. So just let him sell. And that's what they do, you know. And the same thing on the tech side, transitioning to that is difficult. And the flip side of that, which you're mentioning, but I'd like to emphasize, the employee who is given responsibility but not authority is very stressed out, gets frustrated, because they have to keep asking for approval or asking for information to get work done.
Right.
And that eliminates their ability to have meaningful work.
Right.
Interesting thing that you're doing in your organization is you're effectively passing the baton and letting them run their leg of the race.
Right.
And that's critical.
Yeah, the challenge is also to be evolved, right? Because the temptation there, once you start doing that, is just to let them go, right? Use that long leash, right? Versus,
that's right.
All right, let me just check back up on you. Hey, you seem to be struggling more than you should. Let me come back there. Hey, do you need help with this? Do you want me to show you something? Well, I'm doing this. Do you want me to show you something? No, I got it. Okay. Come back an hour later. Why don't I show you that? Yeah, you're right. And, knowing how to keep that in balance there, right? So that, because you still got a client at the end of the day that's waiting on this, right? You're like, it's been 4 hours. You should have been finished in, you know, one or two, or it's been 2 days that it should have been done in one. But when you do go in a way where you're building up that person, and you're not just trying to get something done. And I think they see that, like, you care about them. You want them to be more successful and more trained, and you give them opportunities to grow. So it's a give and take. It's a balance, really. And when we switched to my good stories, I got a couple there on balance.
Okay, well, we're only going to have about 10 more minutes, but I want to mention with a client recently, you know, the way I talk to them about how they delegate or how they agree to get things done. So key thing is they, you know, two people come together, a group comes together and they agree to get something done, that there is a deadline and a time. So it's not, okay, we'll be done by Friday. And one of them thinks that's 9 a.m. Friday morning. And another person thinks it's 5 p.m. And another person thinks it's by midnight Friday.
Right.
So
right.
What's the time of day and the day? And then the second thing is, if you are the person waiting on that deliverable, you can follow up on that the day before or a couple days before. And it's, as you say, really important how you do that follow-up. If you follow up and say, are you on track? Is it done yet? You know, that's authoritative. That's negative. That's bad cop. That's whack-a-mole. Doesn't work. But if you let them, you can let them know in advance. I might check with you a day in advance just to see how you're doing. If you reach out and you say, ideally you do it verbally, but if you need to ping them with an email or a text, and you say, just checking in, is there anything you need from me to stay on track to, you know, deliver that stuff tomorrow at 5 p.m. Then you're offering.
Yeah. And I found, are you stuck on anything? Is anything giving you a hard time? You know, also make it a little bit more, objective, right? A little more abstract. Is anything giving you a hard time versus are you struggling, right? You know, are you having a hard time, right?
Yeah, you try to keep the you know, any type of blame, you know, out of it. That's not the focus. The focus is how do we get there?
Right.
You know, not are you messing up?
Right.
So, all right, let's shift to some of the good. Let's get some good in here before we run out of time.
A couple of good ones here. So, actually, two from college, actually. And that's a long time here, but I thought they were relevant. So, one was my Calc 2 professor, Mr. Knox. He actually wasn't a he was one of the professors that was on loan from, I think it was Texas Instrument or some other large company, on loan to the college to teach. And Calculus 2 was the only class I ever had to repeat, right, in college. So I flunked it the first time, right? Yeah, I know, right? Painful, right? And I like math, right? Just had a terrible time with it. Second one, loved it. Went on differential equations, calculus, all that good stuff was great. But this guy would spend 15, 20 minutes of class trying to home in on one key concept. And then once you got that, like a high level concept about, you know, integrals and like, what is this? And once you got that, he would then walk through all the different layers down to the finest low level detail, you know, and everybody in the class loved him. It was a difficult subject for, I mean, everybody in the class was taking it in summer. So it was we were all there for one reason, right? We had fun through it, taking it. And, I ended up taking him for, you know, another math class, and he was fantastic with that. And the reason why it was fantastic is because he of course had mastered the subject, but he would start the high level and work us down and make sure we stayed with him all the way down to the detailed level. And I thought that keeping that thing in balance, like I was mentioning earlier, was so key.
Well, and that's great, because as a leader, then what he did is he met you where you were. Mm-hmm. So he adapted to you. He did not require you to adapt to him, which would have been impossible because you didn't have his knowledge level. And it sounds like he was also incredibly patient in describing it. So if there were some people in the class that still were like, what? Which would have been me, you know, that he would continue to peel back the onion until they understood. Am I understanding correctly?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'll give you a story on a company. So this is a good boss client story. So this is a maintenance company. So a lot of blue collar workers. And we got the lead in there because the person that was running their IT, which was an internal person, was leaving. And that person had multiple hats and did finance and a few other things. So we came in there to do a project because they were having massive problems and, you know, off of the ongoing support and care and feed of everything. And they were getting, some pushbacks internally. We had sold him, and he was a tough sell on it, right? But they had about 2 or 3 years of tough times, right, of losses, frankly, right? So no one was getting a bonus, and, you know, everybody was kind of, you know, afraid for the company and such. They'd been around for 30 years or so. His father had actually started the business. And just, you know, meeting with him, and he understood the premise and why. So he went back to his staff and faced all of them, basically. He's like, every single one was like, yeah, no, we don't want to support a contract. Don't hire these guys, right? He's like, listen, I know you want, you know, I know you want, we're concerned. And their main thing was, we're concerned about money, and we did it internally before, so we'll figure out a way now. He's like, we can. We got into this mess because we were taking care of our own IT. And we can't get it. We can't get back into that again because we won't be able to focus on, you know, our clients and rebuilding the business. So if we tried to do this job and do our own, we're going to fail at both. It'd be better for these guys to do this at a reasonable cost so we can focus 100% on our jobs. And we're going to be in a better spot if we do that. And he had to do two meetings with those guys. One was not enough. And he did that, brought us on board. We kept everything running, and they were focused on their business, and they were back in the black that year. And they're still there now. Everything is solid there with those guys, and they're a great client to work with. I thought that was.
Well, I think that's critical. And, you know, I mentioned my grandfather was Scottish blood, which I have a lot of Scottish blood. So, you know, I often put myself on the customer side of making a decision on those types of services, you know, like outsourced IT, or it might be something else. And I think one of the things that is part of that discussion often is comparing it to hiring someone to provide the same level of services. And as much as that is somewhat common, I think the actual numbers and considering that, and this whole thing of focusing on what you do best, because that's really only that's the thing that's going to get you where you need to be. And that was in that one thing book that I've talked about from time to time, by the guy who founded Keller Williams, I think it is, the real estate chain that's got like 3,000, you know, locations, franchises, whatever. And, you know, that's what he said, was you really have to focus on what you do best and allocate a significant amount of time to it. And you can't do it if you're being distracted by other things. So good leaders have to make a tough decision. Do we spend money we don't want to spend, per se, on an outsourced service, because that's going to free up my people to really do what they should do. Hate to look at that bill every month, but, you know, if I look at the upside of it, if I can do a good leadership job of getting my people engaged in what they really should be doing, it makes sense. And I think that goes for a variety of companies. You know, there's a lot of outsourced opportunities. Some of them make sense, some of them don't. But if you take the time and really evaluate it, in your case in particular, when you're really relying on technology, if you can get really good technology and people have your back, they're not just selling you everything at every moment, but protecting you. And I'll never forget, back in 2000, we had an outsourced IT guy for our HP-funded startup. I'll never forget. I don't even know what it was, but he told me not to buy something. And right then, I trusted him. It was the thing he told me not to buy that really built my trust in him, not the things that he told me to do, which were always right. He did a great job.
Right. I thought this guy was a good example here, because he could see what was going to get his people to the next place, and he led them there. And it was a good place, right? The proof of the pudding there. Things were good that year.
And it worked. So that's great. So you got one more short one to close out?
Yeah, well, I had Disney, right? Something I studied, Walt Disney here. This is more of one of perseverance and overcoming, right? You know, everybody knows of all the great things they've done and how they've, you know, taken over ABC and ESPN and, of course, Disney World, Disneyland, and all those other great things. But of all the setbacks he had, you know, he had, I think, a dysfunctional relationship with his father at home, and I think he was fired when he was 22 from a newspaper in the Midwest for not being creative enough. Went out to try to be an actor, and that failed. Then became a cartoonist and had some success with Oswald the Rabbit. And it turns out the deal that he signed with the distributor gave all the rights to the distributor. So the thing he created, he actually signed away the rights to. And so I think he had like a 4 or 5 year stint where that was going well with a bunch of cartoons. And then he's like, you know, he had a fight over finances. He wanted more money, and they're like, well, we're going to give you less now. And then they're like, we'll just take it from you because we own it anyway. And they, that group ended up hiring away all the animators that he had trained, all except for two. So the new technology he created with animation, they took it all, including the actual intellectual property. And so he had to restart again. And it's amazing. There's actually a page. I won't get into this one because it gets a little racy. But for Pinocchio, I believe it was, he hired a bunch of midgets to go, to be on the top of a building, and he gave them food and wine. I don't know why they thought wine was a good idea, but they're on top of there. Of course, after several hours, you know, a bunch of guys, bunch of food, it wasn't good, right? And there's a bunch of other failures that Disney's had, but we don't remember the failures, right? We know the phenomenal success, but he persevered it through. And the people that stayed with him, so many people, so many great people that learned and developed these technologies of these ideas they came through. So I think this is a real good example of a leader being able to make it past a lot of the failures. Because there's going to be a lot of failures, right? And there's going to be those that are going to throw rocks at your failures. And you got to be able to keep moving past that and bring with you the people that are going to support you.
I think that's a great way to end it. And there's an old teaching about, you know, that you want perseverance to finish its work so you can be mature and complete, not lacking in anything, and ultimately gaining wisdom. So that is certainly something to pursue. And as leaders, that journey never ends. We have to keep pushing on and pushing on. So I appreciate you being with me today. I know we're pushing the limits on your availability. And I think the stories have been good. It's been good to touch on the millennials again and some good things, good reminders on leaders, not being authoritative, but engaging people, and some things that you're doing there, John. So I hope this new Trek Networks, you know, name and going into the 2018 strong, you know, you close this year strong, and then next year is the best year ever for you and your team because you're doing great work.
Awesome. Good being here, Dave. Good seeing you.
Okay. Thanks, John. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. I always enjoyed talking with John Wilson. Hope you enjoyed listening. Got some tips there. Now, we're going to be back in 2 weeks. My guest is Lorrae Quee. Now, she was an FBI counterintelligence and undercover agent. Woo-hoo-hoo. So she does a lot of cool stuff right now with leaders. And I know you're going to have fun with that one. So don't miss it. We will be back on the 24th with Lorrae. Thank you.